My name is Brendan. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 18th, 1991. So I'm 30 years sober, although I kind of missed it during the countdown. I was praying. No, I wasn't. Anyway, so gotta tell the truth. My sobriety, I told you, so my home group is called Posse on Broadway in Seattle. If you're familiar with the Sir Mix-a-Lot, you know, out that way. Yes, that's exactly it. We meet on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. I tell everyone it's the best Wednesday night meeting in Seattle. Uh-oh. Your organ transplant's ready. sorry, man. Anyways, yeah, I know, right? And, yeah, silence your cell phones because I will point you out. Anyways, I am not afraid, and I can go right back in my talk without even blinking an eye. So my sponsor's name is Kenny D. If you've been around, you might have heard him speak somewhere. Great sponsor. He's been my sponsor since I was about 6 years sober. So the last 24 years, he and I have walked shoulder to shoulder in this thing. And I want to thank the committee for all the work you've done, because I know, I mean, I don't know, I've been to a lot of these things, but I'm telling you, this is well run as a committee, right? So I just want to give a quick hand to you guys. That's amazing.
Is this yours, Brad?
Oh, okay. I was going to do a Facebook post for you. Anyways, so, yeah, so I want to say thank you to that. And Brad, you know, he is like family. And Kate and Tom are here. And I met some incredible, great people here. So I'm very excited to be here. I also want a special thank you to Brad for the accommodations and everything we got going on. There is an inside joke to this. It doesn't say on the website. The rooms look nothing like the website, and they're in a full remodel, so I have a roto hammer on the cement floor of my ceiling above me while I'm laying there. But hey, it's all good, you know, like it's a roof over my head, so I'm not complaining. But it's pretty entertaining. So let's get into it. I was born in Redmond, Washington, and one of five boys in a big Irish Catholic family. We're well represented here. I know that. It's not a preconditioned alcoholism, but we like to party, I guess. You know, our crew, the Irish, are well represented, and Irish and Catholic seem to go together. You know, you don't separate those two, it seems. So go Irish, right? And a lot of my family out from this way, my mom and dad both came from Iowa. So my dad was in Burlington, my mom was in Audubon. They came out west, and that's where they started. And I grew up in a house, and I don't know where you came from, but the way that my house looked like, I'm going to talk a little bit about my family, right? But my story is, you know, obviously, like, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Because the shift that happened within Brendan, the true nature of what I became is because of Alcoholics Anonymous. But what happened in my family and what it looked like when I was growing up is everything looked really well on the outside. Like, we looked like things were going well. And my dad was a... I was talking to Mr. C. I was calling Mr. C. But we were. My dad was a big attorney in town. He came from my whole family. They were attorneys in the Midwest. Law firm in Iowa. I got one of my relatives on the radio in Detroit and other areas. You know, where they all went to Notre Dame. They all became lawyers. You know, it's just kind of the family path. I did not follow that route. I did go to court a lot, I was not well represented either. They were not helping me out, you know. There came a time where they were like, yeah, I don't think so, you know. So you're on your own. But my dad was a great man of the town. He was part of the Chamber of Commerce. He helped start that. Redmond Rotary started that. You know, we go to our Catholic parish on Sundays, and then afterwards we go to the second donut, you know, because the first donut's downstairs after Mass, which we loved. And then me and my little hooligan friends would be upstairs. You know, we're trying to find the key to the wine closet, number one. And number two is we're going through this. I made amends for this before I tell the story, before you yell at me. But I went around the pews and we're looking for the money that people would leave in the envelopes, right? You know, and then forgot to put in the basket because they'd always do these little old ladies put their little stuff in the little pew. And we'd crawl around underneath while they're cleaning, you know, like Rambo. We'd pulling, you know, envelopes and stashing money. We got candy money and alcohol and all that. It was great, you know, and we're in elementary school. You know, I mean, this is not like grown-ups, you know, like we're just little kids, you know, what are you doing playing tag, bye, you know, and out the door, you know. Of course, when we over-imbibed in the wine closet, you know, they found us there once, we got a scolding, you know, but that's usually handled with, you know, a prayer and a little penance, you know, and you're good, so that was nice. And, but you know, when the first time I really got it done, though, in my family, you know, up until that point, what was happening is that I was building more and more in this family life that we're in. The tools for living that I showed up with looked like this. My family didn't talk about problems. We did not talk about the problem, because if you talked about the problem or what was happening, you were the problem because you were shining a light on it. If you brought it up, well, that's you're trying to bring this out in the open. What are you doing? Just forget about it. That was yesterday. You know, and you know, I was 5 years old. I remember waking up, and my dad was dragging my mom down the hallway by the end of her hair, you know, and you know, and beating her up in the bathroom because she forgot to clean something, right? You know, and that kind of stuff was going on. And then, and that night I go to bed and I remember clenching and crying into my pillow, and the next thing I know it's morning. I don't remember falling asleep. I don't remember what happened. I just remember being like this, scared out of my mind, crying, not knowing what to do. And the next thing I know, I'm awake. And I'm just going to let you know, like, when stuff like that happens when you're a kid, you carry that in your, you know, you might need a little help maybe a little later. But we'll get to that. So, but what happened to me is that we got up in the morning and my mom was cooking like it was a Saturday breakfast. Pancakes, bacon, eggs, hair was done, makeup's done, everything's great, sunshiny, you know, fresh. Dad's got his briefcase. He's got three-piece suits going to court. Bye, honey. Love you, honey. And no talk of what happened the night before. And I'm thinking, what did I dream that? Am I crazy? You know, because that's what happened to my family. You know, you fast forward and like my dad comes home and he starts drinking and he starts knocking heads together. And my brothers, it's like the ladder, called the ladder of pain, if you want, whatever you want to call it. But it was this pecking order. You know, my brothers would do this and then the next brother down and then me. And then I hit my little brother, Kevin, and then we'd find him gripping the dog who was going, you know, downstairs in the basement. And the true story, we'd find Kevin like literally going like this, like a maniac on Freckles. Poor Freckles. God dang. Only dog I know that committed suicide. True story. She did. She laid down behind my mom's car and didn't say a peep. My mom backed up over. She's like, I'm out of here. You guys are nuts, you know. And my brother Kevin, you know, he was a little psychopath. My dad came in one night, you know, one day for the dinner table, and he's like, all right, who put the cat in the freezer? You know, and they all look around. It was a little baby brother Kevin. He was like 6 years old or something. He's like, I did. She scratched me, you know. And but this is kind of the tools we have is I was trained early. Like, you know, you punch twice and twice as hard. Like anything happens, you hit them hard and you hit them well. You do not let them come at you. You keep yourself safe. This is about security, what I'm talking about. This is how we operated as a family to keep us safe. Sure, we were infighting and we were maniacs, throwing butcher knives, throwing each other off balconies, throwing each other down the stairs, hanging me out the 18th floor window of a hotel room. That was a good time. You know what I'm saying? Like, these are things that we did. I got angry at my brother Brian. I have no idea what my resentment was to him to this day. But I remember I put needles up in the carpet, so when he got out of the shower, he'd step on them and they broke off in his feet. Yeah, I know, right? Good times. For Christmas this year again, I'm going to send him a little miniature sewing kit. He's 5 years sober more than me, and he actually sends me a picture. He just sent it recently. He's getting it off Amazon. It was black magic, witches, spells, and all this thing, because when he made amends to me, he said, I got to make amends to you and for all these things he did. And he says, and also for all the, you know, satanic magical spells I did over you. He was just kind of glossing over, and I'm like, whoa, what are you talking about, dude? He's like, well, I got really mad. This is the thing, is we were so angry at each other. This like, we just wanted to kill everybody. I want to kill my parents. I want to kill my brothers. And they felt the same to me. You know, so we're all like walking around like homicidal and suicidal in a house full of love, right? You know, and my brother Brian's walking around in the middle of the night going like, you know, doing these spells over us. And in the middle of the night trying to curse us. And I'm like, you psychopath, you know? And I'm just like, oh my God. He just sent it to me. I'll show you afterwards this Amazon link. I couldn't believe he found it. I asked him where he got it. He said the Redmond Library. I'm like, all right, good times. So, you know, by the time I haven't even drank yet. But so by the time I get to drinking, I'm trying to describe that I am so wound up, so absolutely insane. My tools for living is don't talk about it, fight, and fight. That's pretty much it. And my brothers used to tell me, like, go punch that guy or we're going to beat you up. And that's kind of what they would do. And so by the time I got to, you know, I was summer after sixth grade, you know, I don't know where this thought came from. But I'm sitting there and I'm at my friend Mike's house. And his mom, Claudia, comes home. She takes this bottle of whiskey and puts it on the shelf. And she goes back in the bedroom. She's just going to change out of her work clothes. Mike goes back to do something else. And I had this sudden thought that appeared in my brain. Never been there before, but this sudden thought just suddenly went, you should take that bottle, shove it down your pants so no one sees it, run outside and across the street, put it in the bushes and run back and then control your breathing and pretend like you didn't do that. And I'm like, good idea. Woo! And out I go. You know, and that's how we do, right? We get these crazy thoughts in our head. There's nothing to defend us to say this is probably not a good idea. And we just, and this is without even taking a drink, right? Like what ails me is the mental state that precedes my first drink. That's the real crux of the problem, right? And so I already have this built-in wackiness going on. So I'm just like, all right. So I do that. I run outside and I go, bam. And I go out there. I come back. Claudia comes out. Mike's still in the back bedroom. And she goes to pour herself a drink. And like a good friend, I try to help Claudia find it. And we never did find that bottle of whiskey. You know what I'm saying? And she gets mad, thinks it's Mike. I leave. She asked me to leave, really. I didn't just voluntarily leave. She was like, you need to leave. And I'm like, all right, I'm out of here. You know, I clearly don't have the bottle. 2 weeks later, we're on a deck, and we're like, what should we do? I wish we had some alcohol. Oh, I got some. And I went and I got it. And Mike was there. And I brought it out. I put it on the table. He's like, it was you. And I'm like, yeah, man, sorry, dude. Moving on, right? That's the early form of amends, by the way, if you missed it. You know, like, yeah, sorry, dude. And, you know, and then you don't talk about it, because if you talk about it, you're the problem. And so what they do, I remember watching my dad drinking these shot glasses. We didn't have any shot glasses, but we had these old Spaghetti Factory, giant, tall, skinny glasses. And they started to fill those things up and fill those things up. And I drank in a rapid succession, 3-course of bottle of whiskey. And in that moment, yeah, I know, right? Yeah, you know where it's going, right? Not in a good place. But it's my first time really getting it done. I drank some beer. I've shotgunned beer in, you know, in elementary school in the bathroom, you know, done some stuff like that, but not really getting after it. And not knowing my dad had been drinking all day, I see him take a few drinks, and I'm thinking he gets drunk instantly because what it looks like to me, it happens instant. It's like a hit, and boom, he's there. But I just didn't realize he's already inebriated. So I think I got some bunk alcohol. So I'm all angry. I'm like, this stuff doesn't work, and this is bunk alcohol. And I leave the lower deck. I take one step up. The next one is just something happening now. And I struggled to get those out, and that was it. You know, I have a brief recollection that night of what happened. I was a slobbering, emotional drunk. My buddies threw me out. I was crying because I couldn't tie my shoes. You know, and I'm falling down, and Mike's taking pity on me, and I'm hitting my head. I'm hitting the parked cars, and he feels bad, so he goes in a garage, you know, to where he sees this giant motorcycle helmet, you know, and he takes it out of the garage, and he puts it over my head to protect me, you know, and everywhere that thing tilts, I'm falling down. I'm top heavy, you know, and I don't have good reflex, and I'm 13 years old, and this thing's almost out over my shoulders, you know. I'm just like, I'm a minion is what I look like, you know. And so I'm like, you know, and I'm boom, you know, and, you know, off I go, you know. They take pity on me, and they take me to my mom's house, my dad's house. And they take me through the drunk dump. And that's the one where you are taking your friend to a place where you think they'll be safe. And then you quickly exit before you are witnessed as ever being part of it. So you have deniability, right? So he dumped me in the window and he just pushed me in there. My brother comes out, my brother Brian. And he says, you've been drinking, you're drunk, I guess. And I don't remember this, but I like bent over backwards like Mary Lou Renton came back. And you know, like Gumby. And I looked at him, and for some reason he looked just like this beautiful blonde girl who was well-developed in my school named Buffy. And I called him Buffy, tried to make a pass at him, grope him, and he didn't appreciate it. And then my mom came down, and she's like, Jim, your son's drunk, come down here. He's like, which one? You know, and I go upstairs, and it's so good. It worked on my brother Brian. Apparently, I did the same thing to my dad. You know, like, Buffy, you know, and I was very attractive that night, you know. And the next morning, I woke up, and my dad's like, mate, you don't feel so good, you know, kind of deal, you know. And that's the thing is, like, I knew from his tone of voice I shouldn't feel good. He's giving me clues. We pick up on these things when people talk to us who, you know, like, you know, a lesser person would miss this maybe, right? Though, so I pick up on this thing, and I'm like, oh, yeah, not doing good at all. And, man, I was ready for more. Because here's the thing I remembered that night. I didn't go to jail. No one got hurt. No one died. Well, I got hurt a little. I mean, my head and my body a little bit, but nothing I'm not going to heal from. And my brothers beat me way worse than that on a daily basis, so it was no big deal. So, you know, but I'm sitting there and I'm like, this is no big deal. But I remember this, that moment when that alcohol went from the bottom of my belly to my spine and went up and just went through my body like electricity. And it was just like, whew. And for the first time in my life, and the reason I described my family in detail there for a bit and what was going on is because you have to understand when I drank that alcohol, yeah, because I know I'm in a room of people who do understand. What happened for me for the first time in my life, I could breathe. I felt release and I didn't even know I was wound up that tight. I had no idea I was so tense and messed up until I drank. And I felt for the first time in my life true relaxation and true peace. Alcohol was not my problem when I began. It was the solution I had been looking for all along. And it worked. And what's more than that, it would tell you on the bottle exactly how much alcohol was in there. You know, like, why am I going to drink a lot of beer when I could just grab this fifth of alcohol or Mad Dog 2020? Great, please. You know, that was my flavor. Great. And I was worried about quantity, not quality, right? That's what I wanted. So I'm getting flats of beer, that literally the generic beer. By the time I'm 14, I'm running a keg because I stole it from the battalion fire chief, and I got a buddy who'll fill it. The business arrangement, which if you're in business, this is a terrible arrangement, but the business arrangement then was that I got all the free alcohol I wanted at the parties. I maintained the possession of the keg, and he kept all the profits. terrible business move, but great for an alcoholic because it meant I kept my supply. And it meant I could have that stale leftover beer I could pump out of the keg during the week. So I find myself a rapid succession drinking before, during, and after. By the time I'm 14, I also steal the family car. They're on vacation. I crash it. I hurt somebody. I cover up for it. I rob my house, pretend like somebody else did it. I robbed my house. You know, not like I left a note, like, love, Steve, you know. But, you know, and I used to say I faked a robbery. And then one guy came up to me and said, hey, so didn't you, like, rob the house? I said, yeah. He's like, so how was that fake? And I said, God dang, you're right. You know, I meant to fake, like, I'm just pretending here, but I really did rob my family, didn't I? And he's like, yeah, you did. You know, he's all happy about it, you know. And so I understand that now. And, thank you, whoever that guy was. So anyways, you know, by the time, but see the rapid succession, and by the time I'm 15, I'm in my first treatment center. And not my first, that's my first inpatient, because I'm looking at another assault charge. And this time they want to lock me up for 6 months. No time off, no nothing. They want me for 6 months, solid. And I'm like, whatever. And they're looking at, I'm underage, so I'm looking at class A felony. Because I punched him, because it's $3,653. I remember the amount. You know, it was a one-punch fight, cost me a lot of money, and it didn't cost me any money at that time, right? Because that was my dad paid that bill. You know, but I was looking at that time. He said, you know, if you go to treatment, you'll probably get time served. So I had gone to outpatient. I'd gone to some counselors, and they'd already tried to figure out what's wrong with Brendan. I'd gone to psychotherapist, did the Minnesota whatever test thing, and you're manic depressive, bipolar, and this. And if you are, I'm not commenting on your condition. I think if you have a pill and you're doing well, please continue. Don't stop taking it for all, especially tonight while we're here. So, but, you know, wait till tomorrow when I'm gone. Anyway, so, you know, but my truth was that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. So my manic depressive, moods, ups and the downs and all that was because the mania was induced because I was completely out of my mind because either I was drinking or I wasn't drinking. And I was getting worse, not better, drunk or sober. I was getting more and more, like, just down this rabbit hole in my mind. I mean, I was these crazy manic moods that were going on. So they tried some pills on me, tried some other things. But I'm in treatment now for the first time ever inpatient. I go to Wilderness Survival out there. And Wilderness Survival looks like this. Basically, you go 21 days, hike sun up to sundown. You dig a shallow grave every night. You put some flat rocks. You burn some bushes in there. Sagebrush, dead but still standing. You spread the coals. You bury it up so you don't die at night. Because you need the heat or else you will freeze to death. Quite literally, you'll go into hypothermia. So every night I'm digging a shallow grave, just, you know, this is the in treatment. They're like, oh, you're going to do so great. You're going to have this whole new sobriety. I'm out there. I'm in the desert. I haven't showered or eaten, you know, like a regular meal in 21 days. I ate a mouse when I was out there. And I built a trap out of rocks and cliff rose bark and some sticks and a little twig thing, trigger stick, and this whole contraption, and so I can survive in the woods now, apparently. But, you know, but I ate this, and I, you know, if you want to know, it's chicken with an aftertaste of liver. If you're probably sitting there, we are near Kentucky, right, Brad? They might know. Oh. By the way, I should mention there's a giant roll of black grip tape up here. I wasn't sure if this was a promise or a threat, but, you know, I'm just gonna. I'll go with the first one, Brad. Anyway, so I'm out there Wilderness Survival, and I ate this mouse, and I take the little mouse fur, and I put it in this medicine pouch, little leather thing, and I got a rattlesnake vertebrae, and I come back to the society, the world. You know, I got to do 10 days in treatment to get my body back functioning right. And because you lose everything. I mean, nothing fit. My underwear, nothing. I was a skeleton, you know, and I was hungry, you know. And so I'm going around, and now I'm in AA, and I'm going back to these meetings, and they're like going, let's hear from Rat Boy. You know, and they're looking around for the big bad biker dude, and dude, he sounds mean and big and bad. And my name's Rat Boy, I'm an alcoholic. You know, and I went to the desert. You know, and I'm talking in this really monotone, calm way because now I'm calm and I'm spiritual, and I think this is how spiritual people should talk, really breathy and monotone. And I'm just, and you have to drop the word grateful every fifth word, and just, you know, by a loving God and creator. And I did the desert, and, you know, I'm just so grateful that you're here. My gratefulness is grateful of your gratitude. You know, I mean, just, bleh, you know, and I think I know what I'm talking about. And every, you know, I got people coming up to me at the club going like, man, I never thought I'd learn something from someone so young. And then I get to do what they did to me. You know, and I got to do it. Like, yeah, man, keep coming back. Anyways, been here long enough to know that that wasn't a compliment, by the way. And I think they were told by their sponsor, go tell them, keep coming back. Keep coming back, kid. Glad you're here. You know, and off they went, you know. And, you know, because I would take over meetings, much like now. So I'd keep them hostage, you know. And, you know, I'd be like, I'm an alcoholic, and I'd never done a step in my life. And I'd just puke on the meeting, you know. And then we had somebody stand up, and they tried to read from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about some actual stuff that's in our literature and in the steps and all that, some direction. My God, some direction on what to do in this thing. And we'd be like, okay, Mr. Spiritual, you know, the happy, shiny people, right? The shiny, happy people in the corner, right? Like, let's get them out of here. We ran a guy out, literally trying to announce a big book workshop back in those days. Like, hey, big book workshop, shut up. You know, it's my program, not your program. You know, whatever, keep coming back. Right? He's like, all right. He didn't, you know what? He was recovered, though. He's like, you know, I'm not going to fight you guys. I just wanted you to know some information in case you want to come. We're like, yeah. You know, anyways, four step. Yeah, I got resentments. And then we talk about our resentments, right? Nothing to do with the four step. And that's kind of AA I was going to. And guess what? I didn't stay sober. You know, but there were people there. I want to make it very clear. There were people there that were going in that hostile environment who were sober many years, trying to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to those who were willing to listen and were at a point where they could. And there's this old saying in AA, they say, when they're not ready, there's nothing, you can't say anything right. And when they are ready, you can't say anything wrong. And I was definitely in the former rather than the later for a long time. And I suffered immeasurably. I didn't need to, but I don't think, it's not required to do what I was doing then. But it was necessary, because I still had some great ideas on what I was going to do here to stay sober. I had some great ideas on how I was going to do a la carte AA. I'm going to take what I want and leave the rest. You know, I'm going to make amends, but I'm another. And if I'm another, I don't want to harm myself. So, you know, I can't do that amends. I might go to jail. I don't have to do that one. Oh, that's a lot of money. I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do that one. And that's the kind of stuff I was hanging around. It says nothing like that in our big book. In fact, it says everything to the contrary. But I'm sitting here and I'm getting sicker and sicker and worse, and I can't understand why are these guys, some guys coming in, they're getting better and I'm not. So my last treatment center, DSHS bed, that's the state of Washington part, you know, and so they have one bed left, and I want to die. I mean, I truly want to die. I'm just done. I remember leaving a meeting. I was going to an NA meeting. I tried CA. They used the same book, so I just left. You know, and then NA, they used a different book. I'm like, well, maybe this will work. I tried every 12-step thing I could think of with whatever, thinking, well, I'll just do this. Maybe A is not for me. And the truth is that I never did a step. I visited AA, but I was never a member of AA. And what I mean is that I just showed up and I hung out, but that was it. And so with this, I walked home from this meeting. I looked up at the sky to a guy I didn't believe in anymore, and I just said, you know what, out loud, if you got something, you better send it quick because I'm done. And I meant it with every fiber of my being because I knew that I knew I was going to drink again. You know that feeling you get? You just now know. It's a ticking time bomb, but I knew I was going to drink. I had already done it. I had already like fought the thought and drank. I had also come home without even thinking at all. Went up to the cupboard, grabbed a bottle that said cooking wine, chugged it, you know, halfway down. Tasted like soy sauce. It was nasty. Had my buddy come down with 8 beers, got it done. He thought it did too, so we tossed it. I only know what the truth was. I was actually at a Thanksgiving banquet talking with my mom, who was an Al-Anon forever. And she said, oh, honey, I did get rid of all the cooking wine. That wasn't cooking wine. That was Kikkoman soy sauce. And I drank half a bottle of Kikkoman soy sauce thinking, you know, cooking soy sauce made sense to me. So I chugged half a bottle of soy sauce thinking I was going to get drunk, not knowing, you know, and because she got rid of all that, you know. And I always get really thirsty. I talked about that. I still like teriyaki. Anyway, so, I do that. And I'm at this last treatment center. I'm at Sundown and Branch and I'm done. And I do 1 through 5 in there. I think I did 1 through 5. And I do these little things like check, yep, selfish, check, you know, self-seeking, check. Fear, check, 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 check. I am not doing anything of depth and weight is what I'm trying to point out. I was doing check, check, checkity, check. But I've been doing that my whole life. Check. Hey, Brandon, step one, gotcha. 2, off the wall. Off the wall results. You know, I wasn't doing anything right, you know? I mean, because I wasn't getting in depth. I wasn't finding the truth of Brendan. It wasn't until I was a little while separated from alcohol again, crazy, and I knew I was going to drink again. And I met this guy who's a buddy of mine, and we're walking around one day, and I'm like, I haven't seen you. I was like, yeah, man, I'm going to this workshop. This guy takes us through the big book together as a group. And I said, really? The big book? And I literally was like mystified by somebody reading the big book to another person at this point in my sobriety. I'm not joking. You know, like I couldn't understand why we would do that. They give that to you in treatment so that you go to sleep. They tell you that. Literally, read this. It will put you to sleep. And they would give us, actually, funny, the turkey dinner tonight. I was joking about that because in treatment when I was in there, I don't sleep much anyways these days, but man, back then they're trying to give me L-tryptophan pills, which is the active ingredient in turkey to put you to sleep. You know, and so thanks for that, putting them all to sleep before I talk, but you know, that's cool, Brad. I'll pay you back. Anyways, so, you know, I'm there, and this guy says one question to me. I finally go to this guy's place, and I take my book, you know, and I have it here now. It's from Treatment 1989, my first book, you know, that I really ever got. And he said, hey, so why do you think you're an alcoholic? And I tell him all the crazy stories, all the wild stuff I did, all the driving, the drama, and blah, 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 and the fighting, and almost shooting, my, you know, aiming a shotgun at my friend, pulling the trigger, and wasn't loaded. My dad was a good hunter, and I was in a drunk, and I tried to kill myself several times. Somebody kicked the gun out. I was literally on the trigger, pulling the trigger to kill myself. And somebody walked in, saw me, and kicked the gun at the stock. And it went like that instead of depressing the thing. And it was loaded and cocked, or you would have had a different speaker. But, you know, it didn't go off. And he grabbed it. And he's like, what's wrong with you? And I'm just like, I just let me go. You know, because that's where we get, right? Let's just let me go. I'm not doing any good here. But this is where I'm at. And he's looking at me and he's like, because what God had to do to work with them, because God makes use of what he has to work with. What he has, when I was a maniacal egomaniac with no solution. I just said a prayer. I didn't know it was a prayer. I thought I was telling God off, by the way. I thought I was like, up yours, big guy. You got something? Send it. What do you got? You know? And, you know, a little angry guy, you know? And, you know, I'm sitting there and he says, why do you think you're an alcoholic? And I tell him all this stuff. And he goes, that's great, Brendan. I never did any of those things. And I'm an alcoholic. He says, I did things similar to that. And he tells me a little of his story. And he says, but what happens in between the times you're sober and you drank again in those situations? What happened right before you drank? What were you thinking? Like, he starts asking some questions like, well, what happened? Yeah, but when you took that drink, didn't you kind of satisfy that urge and that need? And then what happened after that? And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, well, I'm an alcoholic because I say I am, because that's what they told me, right? And I go back to this treatment center and said, they called this little brain cell. They said, we're going to call this one Alfie. This is a true story. They said, we're going to call this one Alfie. And then Alfie tells this one to drink. And this, so I start telling him about this treatment center thing, this new breaking, cutting edge stuff I learned in treatment. And he's just like, yeah, I don't know about Alfie, but but we got this. And I'm like, okay. And so finally, after a while of just like agonizing, just like sitting there looking at me, asking me the right questions. Because that's a good sponsor. They don't give you the answer. They just ask you the right question. And he just looked at me and said, so do you know why you drank between those times? I said, I really don't know. And he goes, that's the right answer. And he said, why don't we look in this book right here? And he said, we're going to read from the title page, page 164. And we're going to read the story and the journey of these thousand men and women and how they have recovered from alcoholism, from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And we're going to ask the question this, but we're going to go with a strange proposition. We don't know if you're an alcoholic or not. We're not going to assume anything. We're going to look at your experience. What I want you to do is I want you to read through this book, and I want you to circle, highlight, underline, whatever you want to do. Whenever you see something that you drank that way, thought, you know, drink, think, or feel that way. Before, during, and after drinking. When you had Bill talks or any of the people talk, doctor speaking, all that stuff, I want you to just mark it, note it down. I want to see if your experience, yours, validates what's in this book. And when I went about this business by looking at my experience and looking what was in this book and reading the literature, I realized I started to have my own experience. Because what I started to do up until that point is I was going to AA and I was trying to listen to your experience and steal from some of your stuff. A good meeting back then before that was if there was a big emotional meeting and somebody like got really funny or whatever, then it was a great meeting. If somebody broke down, I was really sad, we got some pain out, we talked about the real stuff. You know, about the harm my parents had done and my brothers and life and the police and the judges and how badly I've been treated. It was a good meeting, you know. But what this guy was showing me is that, you know, like here you are at the dead end road of your existence, of everything you've done to try to stay sober, and it's equaled nothing. And, you know, it's basically what I got to. And when I started to read through and I looked at the doctor's opinion, and my mind blew open. I was like, whoa. Because it explained for the first time, why did I drink again? This mental, you know, state that preceded my first drink, this obsession that would not leave me alone until eventually I drank. And that's what I meant about telling God off that night, because I could feel that obsession, that low, just that little Chinese water torture drip of drink, drink, drink. And I knew it was coming. And I knew I was going to fight it for as long as I could, but I knew it wasn't going to last. Because I knew I'd known my experience. I wasn't going to be able to do it. If I could choose and fight it on my own, I would never go to AA again. Right? I just choose never to drink again. I choose not to drink. I'm done. Thank you very much. Sorry I wasted your time in treatment. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, that kind of thing. You know, but what I found was that I am the guy that drinks no matter what. I do not choose. What I do choose is to follow a spiritual program of action, which Alcoholics Anonymous laid out, and I did exactly what they said, which allowed me, then a byproduct of that, it was that God kept me sober. I went like this, and God took care of the rest. right? You know, but when I get to this guy, I'm thinking, I don't know anything. And so we're going through this book and I'm looking at the doctor's opinion and I understand for the first time, why is it when I take that drink, I don't drink like other people? Why do I see some people get buzzed? You know, my mom, on her birthday, we tried to get her drunk once. And my mom didn't drink at all. She just didn't like, you know, the alcohol. And by this time, the family, I'll say this part of the story, is that we kind of reformed our family. Because when my mom kicked my dad out, you know, my mom bore a lot of the brunt of the anger and the rage and everything. Because dad wasn't there anymore, so mom got that. Which is the sad truth of what happens a lot to abused women, you know, is that once they leave, then they become the center point of that abuse. You know, but now we're all here and all of our brothers, we're doing good. And we're sitting there with my mom. We're trying to get her to take some more. And she just exclaims out loud, like, no, stop it. I don't like it. I'm starting to feel out of control and I don't like it. And we're like, what? You know, because I'm just thinking, Mom, you're almost in the promised land. Just push through to the other side. You know what I'm saying? Like, she is almost home. We got her to the cusp and we're like, come on, Mom, just four more shots. You know, and it's like, no. She has this natural, innate thing within her that says, yo, in her primal brain that says, this is when bad stuff happens. We need to be alert about what's going on around us. She had a natural propensity to not like it. And me, I'm like, oh yeah, let's go further, deeper, harder, right? Like, we're going all into this alcohol torture, right? Like, we're in, you know, and she wouldn't do it. I'm dating a girl right now. I open the fridge in the morning and sometimes she'll have like a glass of wine with dinner the night before and she'll have half a glass of wine in there. And I'm like, what the, you know, I literally have said that out loud in the morning, like, what the, you know, like, what are you doing? Like, why do that? You know, like, I don't understand it. You know, normal people bewilder me, you know. I remember, I should say this kind of funny, just a side note, like the first time her dad was there and I'm meeting her dad and I was like, oh, I'll be nice. I'll get her I don't do wine or I'm drinking water, but I'll get her a refill in her glass of wine. I go in the kitchen and she has this big giant stemware bowl thing. And so I fill it to the top. It just seemed natural to me. And I bring it out and she's like, whoa. And her dad's like, somebody's trying to get lucky. And I'm just like, and so then she gives most of it to her dad. And he's like, well, you might, but wrong person. I'm like, oh Jesus, you know. This is my kind of family, you know, but anyways, right? Yeah, a good sense of humor, you know, and, but you know, what my sponsor did for me is he took me through those steps. And so I got the first step. I understood for the first time why I drank the way I did. I have a physical allergy that happens within me. I see people with peanut allergies and they say, if I do this, my throat will swell up and I'll die. And I'm like, so you don't experiment with, you know, peanut butter pies or peanut butter ice cream or... Have you tried the sugar-free peanut chips, peanut butter cookie things? They're fairly good, you know? Like, I would never say that to him. I'd be like, dude, are you trying to kill me? Yes, you know? Like, you know, but without, if you substitute alcohol in there, I'm like, well, maybe. I've never tried some of the things they've come out with now. I mean, there's that super spicy cinnamon fireball crap. You know, I'm sure I'd probably like, and I doubt it. I doubt I'd like that. I'm a vodka guy, you know? Jack Daniels, Bacardi 151 rum, that kind of, you know, just like, let's get it done, you know. And, but he leads me through and I'm looking at the second step and I'm starting to set aside everything I think, you know, because I have to have a new experience. If I'm going to last here, I can't have the experience I had before. I'm starting to have the first experience I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous in recovery. And when I get to that third step, I honestly did not believe this thing would work for me. Didn't believe this was going to work. I thought, there's no way I'm going to get what you guys have. You guys have freedom and that's not available to a guy like me. And I don't mean like, you know, like I wasn't intelligent enough or whatever. I just mean like, I honestly thought that it wasn't going to work. I honestly thought that I was alcoholic and something else. I thought I was something else beyond alcohol. I had something beyond alcoholism because I tried this stuff and I couldn't stay sober. And so I get through there and I do my third step. And I say, God, please give me a sign. I go up and I get on my knees and I look up on the ceiling. There's these giant circle and triangle things, you know, the symbol of AA. And I'm like going, whoa, that's a big sign, you know, and I'm kind of freaked out, you know. And I go home and I say the prayer, which if you're new, never say this prayer. I go home to begin my fourth step inventory. And I say, God, please give me enough resentments to have an adequate fourth step. And that's a real prayer. It's free. You can use it. I'll give you my phone number and email. I want to know how that happens later for you. Really, I'll stay on the phone to listen. So, you know, I do that, and I have to get up and go get more pieces of paper, and I'm puking my soul. I'm having this just all, and I realize that, you know, I'm angry at every single person I think I've ever met. I have people like, you know, red cap dude in a blue car in 1987, you know, and, you know, on 164th Street, you know, and cut me off, you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, like that guy and this guy at this concert and that guy in there. And I don't remember his name, but he left and never talked about it. I hate him, you know. And then the other thing started happening. I was remembering names I never could remember before. I asked my mom through my whole childhood, what was that guy, my best friend, you know, in first grade? You remember my best friend in first grade? She's like, I remember, I can't remember his name. I'm doing my inventory, and all of a sudden I'm like, Kelly! Kelly! That's his name, you know? And, you know, and I'm writing inventory on Kelly. Kelly was there one day, and he just abandoned me one day. Like, I was angry from first, and I was angry at stupid stuff. You know, like, I mean, that dude just moved. He didn't have time to say goodbye. Who knows what was going on, you know? And, you know, but I'm still carrying that crap around. So I get to my fifth step, and I'm sitting down with my sponsor, and he's like, let's find out what's wrong with Brendan. Because he's really curious. And, you know, and so we started looking down, and I can summarize it by this. There's an inventory I always talk about because it sums up the whole thing, really, in a fifth step. And that is, I have this one. I'm doing my brothers and sisters and all of the major stuff, you know, and I did this, I did that, you know. And then I have this one in there, and it says, people who drive by and stare at you with that effed up attitude. And my sponsor goes, what? And I go, people who drive by and stare at you with that effed up attitude, and I start to explain the details of how this looks. And it's, I'm walking along in the street, I don't know if it's the Metallica shirt that says Metallica Kill 'Em All, the mullet, the mouse pouch, you know, Rat Boy deal going on with the, you know, the mullet, you know, I don't know. And, you know, but I'm walking along, and I'm just like, you know, like this, you know, like, angry everywhere. And everyone's staring at me everywhere I look. I mean, grandparents, young people, everybody, I'm walking along, and I'm like, what are you looking at? What are you looking at? I'm just busy. I'm busy on the roadway. I'm watching, you know, like, you know, you're in an AA meeting and somebody stares at you and you don't back down. You got to stare them down, right? You know, that kind of attitude stuff is going on. And he's like, what? And I'm like, yeah, you know, and he's like, Brendan, how do you know they're staring at you? And I'm like, well, and I start just out of my side of my neck. And he's just like, Brendan, pause. Think about it for just pause, because he's been doing 10, 11 with me at that point. Early on, by the way, he did that out of work. He's like, you need to start praying and talking to God now if you're ever going to make it. Because you are not going to make it. You know, he was a real good cheerleader. You're going to die. Anyway, so, you know, so, geez, man, swear to God, you know. I don't know if you had that sponsor. He'd hang up on me. Did you guys, that was when they had the actual phone you could hang up on, you know. And John would be like, you know, I'll get to that. You know, but he'd just bang, just hang up on me. He'd say, bark something at me. And I'd be like, nah, sniveling. He'd be like, yeah, click, you know, go help somebody. Clang, you know, I'd be like, God. Jerk, you know, and that's how he was raised, you know, this thing. And so, but anyways, you know, I'm doing this inventory, and I'm like, people drive by and stare at you with that effed up attitude, and he's just like, pause. And finally, all of a sudden, on the third time, all of a sudden, this thing just goes, I'm like, oh my God. I looked up and go, oh my God. And literally, it was an oh my God moment for Brendan, but I'm like, I'm staring at them. And he's like, Eureka, you know, and April from the other room's like, do we know what's wrong with Brendan yet? He's like, we're getting closer, you know, and, you know, he's like, nope, you know, and she's laughing, you know, his wife in there, and they're yucking it up, you know, and at my expense, but hey, that's cool, you know, and but I realized what's happening is that these people aren't staring at me at all. I'm literally drawing everything in my inventory, I'm drawing into my life. I'm literally angry, resentful, I'm throwing all these daggers out there to society. I can't even walk down a street without staring and interacting with every living driver soul that I run into and trying to fight with them because I'm so angry, I just want to kill things. And so they're just like, you know, like, what's wrong with, you know, I'm sure they're going by like, oh, is he okay? You know, like, oh, maybe he needs some help. He looks very upset, you know, like maybe, you know, like whatever. You know, I'm sure they have these people are probably naturally compassionate or maybe indifferent, who knows? But it doesn't matter what they're thinking or what they're doing. What matters is what Brendan's doing. And what I'm doing is I'm staring at the world and then world's reacting to that and bringing right back home what I'm delivering out there tenfold. And I'm realizing my entire inventory, my entire life, this is exactly what's happening in my life. And so I leave there after this inventory going like with these big chunks of truth going, oh my God, my entire life I've drawn this whole thing. I'm miserable and I want to die because I've done it to myself. I've lived out here in the cold and I've been doing this. I'm throwing it out here. You know, and so I go into 6 and 7, and he's like, you're going to give you a week or a couple weeks, I think he said. And within a week, you know, I'm calling. I'm going like, dude, I think it was actually on day 3. I'm like, I can't wait 2 weeks, dude. I need to do the 6 and 7. Every time I'm about to do something, I can clearly see what's going on. I'm starting to become aware, you know, and it's not an overnight matter. You know, I was driving home once, and I'm driving in the car, you know, and I'm now, like, you know, 6 and 7. I'm doing 8 and 9. I'm making my amends list. I'm trying to go out and do amends. I'm trying to live differently. And this guy's on my butt, like, just tailgate me. I'm like, just stay calm, Brendan. Don't react like you've done in the past. You know, leave the tire iron. Leave it where it is. Don't put your hand on any weapons. Just drive home. You're home. And I'm literally, like, a mile from the house. And I just got to go a mile. Just got to make it a mile. And I turn the corner. There's 4 lanes, a one-way. There's nobody on the street, just me. And nice guy. And, you know, behind me. And I pull wide turn, so I'm in the far left because I got, you know, about a half mile up. I got to turn left to go up the hill. And he pulls all the way right behind me. And I'm like, dude, you got 3 lanes to pass me. Come on, man. And I'm trying, praying, please, God, please, God, please, God, please, God, please help me not kill this guy, you know. And that was Johnny say, Brendan, we don't kill people here one day at a time, you know. And true story, yeah. And so I'm trying to do the John prayer, like, we don't kill people here one day at a time. And, you know, saying the surrender prayer and all this stuff. And I'm just like, oh, God. And then I'm turning left, and he finally goes around me. I'm like, thank God, I made it. And he gets right in front of me, goes, whoop! I'm like, whoop! I'm like, whoa! Bam, old Brendan back, drop the clutch, pull the brake, go, whoop! We're going 85, 80 miles an hour through downtown Redmond. And if you don't know Redmond, that's where Microsoft headquarters is. And they have like 7 cops for every one person, including SWAT probably, right? And they are well funded, you know? And so we're going, and that's sometime, for some reason that night, they were all sleeping somewhere. We went through the whole town, not one cop. I could not believe our luck. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're going to die. And I'm looking at him in the mirror, and he's looking back, and I turn the light on, and I'm going like this, going like, kill, die. And I'm just like, bah. And they're just, the dude's like, eyes get like this big, and he's like, oops, wrong guy, you know? And I got a full, and I'm sitting there, I'm going like, I got a full tank of gas. You know, and I'm just from mouthing the words like, you are so dead. Like, I have 4-wheel drive. I'm good, dude. Wherever you go, I will follow and I will murder you, you know, for braking on me. Why'd you kill him? Well, he pumped his brakes. That'd be a great defense, you know. I felt threatened by his brake lights. Anyways, so, you know, I'm going through town and all of a sudden I had this quiet, still voice that just says, Brendan. And it's just like, literally, I can't explain this. I'm so loud in my head, and all of a sudden I guess it's just, Brendan, what are you doing? And it's just more like an assertion and a question kind of thing at the same time. And I just like let off the gas, and I'm going up the hill. Because after that, it's all country. It's a 2-lane country highway, 50. And I know it like the back of my hand. I've driven it drunk. I've driven it sober. Since I was 13, you know, like I know this road. He's gone. And I let off the gas, and I just go on the turn lane and put my little signal on, and I go 25 miles an hour all the way home. And I pull in my driveway, and I put on the brake, and I'm like, okay, we had a little relapse there of anger for a moment. Thank you, God, for steering me back to sanity there before I committed murder. And I went inside, and I prayed. I did my little thing. I talked to my sponsor the next day about it. And he goes, well, we don't get better here all at once, Brendan. But I'm glad that you continue to do this, because I have no doubt you probably would have gone to jail that night. And, you know, and that's how it started to happen for me. I'd start to catch myself halfway. People are gossiping. I'd walk up, and I'd be like, I'd want to join in. I'd want to add to it because I didn't want to feel like I wasn't, you know, part of. I don't want to be rejected. And whatever you're doing, I need to do what you're doing so that I'm accepted. And I stopped participating in stuff like that. And, you know, what happens when you stop doing that is people don't like to gossip around you if you're not participating. They naturally just stay away from you because it makes them uncomfortable. When you sit there and you're like, well, I don't know. I don't really have any experience with that guy. When you start being honest, saying, well, I don't know. Maybe there's a different side to this. You know, I start living a more principled life, meaning what I'm doing is I'm looking at the principles in our spiritual program. And I should point out, we read it in How It Works all the time. It says, the principles we have set down are guides to progress. Not that I set down, because I used to say it all the time. It's my program, not your program. You know, not do it my way I want. You know, and really, it's like, no, dude, actually, they put it down in black and white for you so you wouldn't screw it up, because they were quite certain you would, which you are. And so, you know, they said, hey, you can't claim spiritual progress if you're not even progressing on the roadmap of spirituality they laid out in front of you, you know? And I'm like, oh, that's news to me. You know, my sponsor, he was the loving kind that would say, Brendan, that's not called balking. That's called no longer willing to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous when you're sitting on your inventory for 6 months. And I'd be like, ouch. You know, when you say it like that, it's not so, I mean, when I say, well, I'm balking, it sounds nice, doesn't it? It sounds like a nice word. I'm balking. Balking on down the road. Do have my experience in AA. You know? But if you're like, hey, you're no longer willing to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous since 6 months ago. You're like, oh, yeah, I am. Well, no, you're not. You know, and I'm not saying that for you. I'm just saying that's what he said to me in my experience. If you're matching up with that right now and you're getting a little upset, well, that's not my deal. I am not owning your stuff. Okay? So, you know, and I got into my amends and I start going around the community and I start making amends. And here's the thing. I did a lot of damage to my community. I got away with a lot of stuff because my dad was a city attorney. And a lot of stuff went on, you know. But at some point that ended. And so I went back and I made amends. And I made amends to the city of Redmond, and I made amends to the mayor because I was on a first-name basis with the mayor. She went, all the politicians went to my church, so it made it easy. So, you know, I was talking to him, and, you know, go Irish Catholics again, right? So I'm there, and Rosemary, you know, and I make amends to her assistant, and I make amends to her, and then she says, wrong place, go down and make amends somewhere else. And they're like, well, wrong person, make amends to somebody else. And then they send me a whole other campus and building in the city, and I make amends to them. They're like, no, wrong person. Here's Northside Street, so I make amends to them. Then I go to the South Street crew, and they're like, no, that's the right side, but that's actually signs and markings. So by about the 10th or 11th or whatever time it was on that day I'm making this amends, I'm carrying the message of AA. But each time I'm making it, these people are truly curious about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because sad to say, I'm like the first person that's come to them and talked to them about Alcoholics Anonymous and making an amends for the harm I did, because I did harm. I worked and I took vacation time from my job and I started doing this, paying it back by making signs and installing and working for volunteering, community service, which I was used to, and you know, and doing that stuff. And they're like, hey, do you think you're done? I'm like, oh, I probably got days, because I didn't know this. But by the way, some of those reflective anti-graffiti signs, not to freak out if you're new, if you owe amends for this, but one of those things I found out was $650 at the city of Redmond. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to work here forever. But they offered me a job. They're like, you want a job? I'm like, no, I'm not here for a job. I'm here to do this amends. They're like, look, we're going to pay you $2 more an hour than we're getting over at Shucks Auto Supply. Because by the way, I said a prayer, said, God, I'll take any job that you give me. And that's the only one that was available. And then I instantly realized I need to be more specific in my prayer life, by the way. Because I did not want to look like a NASCAR race driver working behind the thing and my friends see me, because we were too cool for school, right? But you know what? I learned a great thing. I learned about, you know, how to fix my car. I had to learn some good things. I went to City Redmond and I start working there. And I get favorite city employee, and the mayor takes me out to lunch. They put my picture in the paper, and it's no longer in the police blotter. You know, it's pretty impressive, you know. And people are like, what the heck's going on here, you know. And I learned this crazy, like, they make me take these classes for, like, advanced first aid, CPR, and all this stuff. You know, and you never know how these things are going to go, you know. But I saved two, you know, it was weird. After I had that training, I saved two people, you know, with that training. You know, I saved their life. One of them was my brother. I was in the house. I heard him fall off the roof. We were re-roofing my mom's house. And I was, ooh. And I knew from the sound, I was like, something's, I got to hang up. I got to call 911. I didn't even know it was wrong, but I knew something bad had happened. And I went out there, and he had two big, you know, chew plugs in his mouth, and he was choking on him, and he was blue, and he was doing a seizure. And so I rushed down there, like, you know, just slid tackle in there. He happened to be positioned, and I grabbed him, and I was trying to, I can't do him because I don't know if his neck's broken, his back's broken. I know what's going on, but I know I got to get that out of there because he can't breathe. And I just made amends to City of Redmond. They just happened to give me the training I needed to save his life. And I just said a prayer. I was like, and I was crying. And I'm telling you, I was freaked out. And I just said, yo, God, please help me save my brother. And I yelled it. You know, I just went down like this. And I tried to get a stick in his mouth to scoop, you know, and I couldn't do it. He was seizing. So I just hit as hard as I could and up. And it was just enough to cough it up. And then I was able to take that stick and pry his jaw a little bit and get it out. And the fire department was there on time. Impressive response time. Impressive. And they put in there, you know, brother saved his life. You know, because he was going to be dead. He was that, I mean, he was done, you know. And, you know, because he was not breathing. I was working on it for a while trying to get that thing out of there. And you know, and my brother, you know, it's like to this day, you know, it's, you know, we got love for each other. You know, is that... We hated each other growing up, right? You know how it is, you know, with your siblings and especially my Irish brothers. But, you know, he looked at me and all his blood. He goes, I guess I owe you. And I said, yeah, you do. You know, and I bring it up every once in a while just to joke with them. Be like, well, you know, you owe me your life, you know. And we chide with each other, you know. But my family, you know, I want to say that, you know, we've come back together, you know. And in the early days and holidays and Thanksgiving and stuff like this, it was a nightmare. So if you're experiencing that for your first time, I want you to know I understand. I get that. It's very difficult in the beginning to try to readjust, and when you're not when you're having those moments like that road rage stuff I described, you're kind of going like you're sober, serenity, and all of a sudden you're completely spiritually bankrupt for a moment, then you're back. I get it, you know. But, you know, at some point we all kind of grew together and we were all trying to do recovery as best we could. And, you know, we started to patch all the holes in the wall, rehung all the doors in the house. We painted all the doors, painted the whole house. I had 16 holes in my door, in my bedroom, fists and kicks. And somebody threw a vacuum through the wall downstairs, you know. It bonked them in the head on from the stair when they were vacuuming. So it's the vacuum's fault, so they threw it through the wall. You know, that's how we do things, right? You know, and so, you know, we're rebuilding this thing, and I make amends to my mom. And I wish I could tell you my mom was my first one, but it wasn't. And I went to her and I talked about all the money and the cars and all these things and all these things I'd done. And she said, here's the one thing. You know, I wanted to do my mom's men perfect. You know, I really did. I even called my sponsor. And of course, I complained to him, which is also a bad idea if you do that to your sponsor, because you better be ready for an answer. And I just said, you know, she's going to make me pay back all this money. I owe all these thousands of dollars. And I mean, I owed her a lot of money. And he goes, you'd be lucky if she allowed you to pay back for $8 an hour. Clang! You know, and I'm just like, geez, you know. And he thought it was actually too much. She ought to pay me less. And I'm like, that's not nice, you know. And, you know, and so I make amends to my mom and I get done. And she just, you know, the only comment she said, I was convinced my mom was going to rake me over the coals and all this. And we got these funny ideas of how things are going to turn out, don't we? We tell ourselves these crazy stories. And the story becomes our reality, only to find out it's not true whatsoever. And my mom sat there and she said, oh, honey, I'm just glad you all survived. I missed it, you know. I wanted to get it right. And I realized that this is the moment, and I have two little girls. They're 10 and 8, you know. And I can't imagine the things I did and the things I said and the way I treated her and the way I treated my family being reflected from my little girls growing up like that. I'm sure you can check back with me in about another 5-6 years and find out how's it going, Brendan, you know. And if you got some tips on that, I would be willing to listen. I have learned to listen in this thing and take advice from experience. And I realized that what it was is that my mom, every time I went out the door, she wondered, is this the last time I'm going to see my son? Is this the last time I'm going to see him alive? What's the last conversation we just had? And I thought, there were a lot of ugly conversations and a lot of middle fingers and language that I would never say. I would never let anyone talk to my mom that way. I would cut them down if they talked to her the way we talked to her. But yet I was doing it to her. I was treating her like that. And I realized, my God, this is what I've done. I've let this woman in. She did also used to hide in my bedroom though when I'd sneak out at night, you know, and she'd scare the crud out of me. You know, that was always fun. She'd come out of the closet like, there you are. I'd be like, oh, God. You know, just, I think she kind of liked that. It's their Al-Anon relapse going on. Anyway, so waiting for me, you know, and God dang, she was nutty sometimes. And but she passed away. But here's the thing, you know what? My mom never. I gave her the gift that she had asked for in that amends. She never had to worry about me. She never had to worry. Where is Brendan? Is he safe? Is he okay? She knew without a doubt that I was okay and I was safe and I was okay. And that's all she ever wanted. She wanted to know I was okay and are you happy? Are you okay? She didn't care about all the other stuff. You know, and I made amends to my dad, you know, and he was in his law office and he hung up. He said, hold on. And he hung up and he said, that was Detective so-and-so. He wants you to know that you're no longer on the persons of interest list. And I'm like, I didn't know they had a persons of interest list. He says, Brandon, I'm city attorney and I didn't know they had a persons of interest list. But you're not on it. And I'm like, score one for the dailies, you know. And, so I'm there and, you know, my dad, you know, and he asked me, you know, even after all the crazy nightmare stuff we went through with that, he said, is there anything your mother and I could have done to not, you know, have you go through this path or go to treatment or be an alcoholic? Because there's a lot of families out there that go through, they think somehow they're to blame. They did something wrong. Maybe my dad's drinking, maybe the stuff that they did, maybe the stuff that went on, maybe he was responsible. I just said, Dad, I just want you to know there is absolutely nothing you could have done. I have something inside me that is beyond you. I have an allergy, and I was able to explain to him in a clear textbook definition of what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. And I said, look, man, I suffer from alcoholism, Dad. I have this mental obsession that's nothing to do with you. And then once I take a drink, the problem is that I have little or no control of the amounts I'm going to take, and I don't know where that's going to go. It's choose your own adventure depending on what's available and what's going to happen and where I'm going to end up. You know, and I thanked him for the times he showed up in jail and the times he stood with me in court. Even when it was a judge who hated his guts and sentenced me for a longer time. That's what I meant about not well represented. You should look who's on the docket before you walk in. Anyways, Because we walked in, my dad goes, "Oh no." And I go, "What?" And he's like, "She doesn't like me." I'm like, "You're my lawyer." You know? And she gave me the full, she gave me the, actually on the back of your traffic tickets, they say $10,000 and up to 5 years in jail or whatever, you know. And she gave me $10,000 fine, suspended most of it. And she gave me the full 5 years of this thing, like, and like suspended all of it but this. And so if you didn't pay it, there's no more court. You just go to jail. There's no more like, you know, "Hey, wait, don't lock me up." And yeah, she really hated my dad. So, you know, but I was able to make amends. We were able to patch things up the best we could. And here's the thing I'm going to talk about with forgiveness and stuff. And that is this, is that, you know, it's hard to get over a lot of the stuff that we've gone through and things like that. And that it's, you know, like it, we set them aside entirely. We just look at what we've done. We own our behavior, what we've done. There's also this thing where I could never find peace with my dad, and I could never find peace in this world because I kept trying to forgive him. I did the, you know, like, "I forgive you now and forever." You know, and, you know, the Marianne Williamson, "I'm gonna surround you with the light," you know, and, you know, the Emmett Fox and all that. And I was trying all these different things. And then my dad, you know, something would happen. I'd get all upset again. And then I'm sitting there doing dishes one day with my buddy Mike, Mike L from Indianapolis. And he says, "Brendan, how's it going with that?" I said, "You know, this going on." He's like, "You know, it's pretty simple, really." And I said, "How is it simple? I've been struggling with this for years." You know, and that's the old timer stuff. "Well, it seems pretty simple to me." You're like, "Oh, okay, Mr. Benevolent," you know, and, you know, "tell me about it," you know, and "thanks for letting me sit over here and suffer for so many years." And, you know, but he just says, you know, like, "Well, you just sounds like you need a new idea around your dad." And I'm thinking, new idea? I remember that in the sex inventory, but what's he talking about? He says, "Well, your dad clearly can't show up the way you're demanding him to be. And there's nothing wrong with what you're asking him to show up as. But the fact is that he's proven beyond the shadow of a doubt right now, he's completely incapable of that." And I was like, "Oh, huh." And I realized for the first time that I'd been unfair to my dad, even though all the stuff he was doing was messed up and there was some crazy stuff going on, but it was unfair of me to demand something on him he could never meet. And what I realized is that the father I am today, the ever-present dad that I am in my girl's, my daughter's life, I am there every day I'm supposed to. I keep promises because it's important. They have never seen me take a drink. They've never seen me hit anybody. I've never hit them. I've never thrown anyone out a window or through a wall. I haven't driven like a complete, total maniac down the road going, "I'm going to kill you," you know, pulling them over and pulling guys out of. None of that stuff has happened. I haven't done any of that stuff. I've taught them about love, compassion, and it's hilarious if you have kids and you teach them about meditation. You know, my little daughter Fiona's out there and she's like, "Hey, ready to meditate? We're going to breathe. Breathe in. And then exhale," you know, and I'm doing like this quiet, you know, like breathing exercise. She goes, and I'm like, "That's good enough." You know, and it's a beautiful thing. You know, you're sitting here and you're meditating, praying with your kids. You're just like, "This is weird," you know, and they can't stay very long. You know, I can stay an extended period of time. They last about 30 seconds. They're like, "Bing!" You know, and, you know, they're just gone, you know, and they got that high energy that dad has, you know, just never-ending energy, you know, and so I'm in trouble. So you can say some prayers for me. And the great thing is that, you know, I work with a sponsor, a lot of guys. I got to wrap it up here, but I've been in service work a long time. And when Bill went and talked to Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob was trying to get sober, you know, Bill was going to talk to him because he was in danger of drinking. He wasn't trying to save Dr. Bob. And it taught me a very powerful lesson. My sponsor pointed that out because I was trying to sponsor a bunch of guys and, you know, a lot of them weren't staying sober. And he said, "Yeah, you know, just like Lois had said to, you know, the Bill, the rumors that, you know, yeah, but you did." You know, and Dr. Bob going to the hospital all the time, and what they found is like that great access he and that gift to AA he did, that going into, you know, the hospital, Sister Ignatia, you know, doing that and starting AA and doing that work, and one alcoholic talked to another alcoholic where no other person could reach them. Because I had been thrown every counselor, big money counselors in our area, psychiatrists, they threw money at the problem. And none of them could fix what was going on. Because what needed to be done didn't need to be fixed. It needed to be discovered, uncovered, and then I could recover. But not until I got the truth about myself could I ever start on that path with Alcoholics Anonymous gave to me. You know, there's a quote that popped up on my memory, and it was from the, you ever seen the baseball movie The Natural? Great movie. There's a quote in there. He says, I believe that we have two lives, the one we learn with and then the one we live with after that. So if you're wondering right now and you're suffering through the life that you've been that you've learned with, I want you to know that the greatest tools that I've ever had in my life, the greatest, darkest secrets in my fifth step and those things have become the very pain points and touchstones of somebody else's freedom. Because I've been able to sit there and one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, like we're here to know. We look around the room, a room full of alcoholics, and what we get to understand in that moment, those intimate moments, those fifth steps, I'm sharing with him my deep, dark secrets and what happened. And they don't become secrets anymore. And they don't become dark. What they become is moments of understanding, compassion, and freedom. And their ideas that are haunting them, this little new growth of God switches places. And that idea of God becomes massive, and that problem doesn't seem so big anymore. Because they realize the guy across from them is a man with a real answer, that I have been there, I have walked in that dark, and I'm no longer there anymore. You, and this is the great thing, is that there are people I can talk to you can never reach, but there are people you can talk to I can never reach. Each person in here can reach somebody that, each other, we don't know who that is. That's the great gift. I don't know who I'm talking to tonight. I know I'm talking to a room of people, but I'm not here for everybody. I'm going to make that point right now. I'm here probably for maybe, who knows who that is? Yeah, back there, right on. You know? But that's the great gift we get, is we don't know who we're here to help. We're just here to carry the path, this blind faith that maybe what I'm passing on, maybe somebody's going to get something from that. Maybe they'll start anew. Maybe they'll get honest with their sponsor and be like, hey, man, I'm 8 years dying over here in the corner silently because I'm too afraid to tell anyone that I'm screwed up. We don't do this thing. We're not supposed to, like, get to a graduate spiritual level. I've gone through divorce. I've gone through some of the hardest stuff. I had to file for custody of my kids. I'm in the custody battle right now because mom was in a meth trailer, you know, and that's not okay. You know, my kids are safe right now with their grandparents, you know, her parents, you know, and she fled back there. And I don't hate my ex-wife. She's a beautiful woman. She's also sick. That's just the truth. I just want you to know, you know, I'm trying to cry, man. I'm just overwhelmed. But, you know, with when I talk about that, it's really current. And it's a difficult thing. But there's a bottom of the 10th step going to the 11th that says, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone. And that is where I live today. I try to live, I've ceased fighting anything or anyone. Because if I'm trying to still fight what's going on out here, arrange my sobriety or arrange my stuff to get an end result, I'm not living in faith. I'm not doing this thing, what it's talking about. I need to wake up every day with a strange proposition that, God, I don't know what your will is for me today, but please help me to help the newcomer. Help me to be of service to people in my community. Help me to be of service wherever I am. Whatever that looks like, thy will, not mine, be done. And that seems so trite and stupid when I first got here and like, oh, that sounds like a little slogan jingle-y thing, you know. And but you know what? When it gets to the gut of your soul and you get the truth of that and you start living there, it's no longer some trite little flippant thing. It becomes a way of life and a principle on which you can stand firmly upon. Thank you.